This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. Today I'm speaking with Richard Bett, professor of philosophy and classics at Johns Hopkins University and author of How to Keep an Open Mind, an Ancient Guide to Thinking Like a Skeptic. We discuss the pros and cons of the only Greek skeptic whose work has survived, Sextus Empiricus, and what we should take away from this very interesting school of thought. Now, should you be a skeptic? What really was ancient philosophy, and how has it changed over the millennia?
I want to say thank you, first off, for taking the time to talk to me today. And I think it's just really interesting skepticism, because I feel like there's quite a big difference between skepticism as how people say it today versus skepticism as an ancient philosophy. And indeed, right now, saying somebody's a skeptic is almost like a bad word. So perhaps the best way to start is to just explain the differences between what we think of a skeptic is today and what the ancient philosophy actually was.
Sure, yeah. And I think, I mean, there's certainly some overlap. I mean, yeah, I mean, a skeptical person, as we think of it today, is someone who's inclined to be doubtful, who doesn't accept anything without a lot of, you know, persuasion. And yeah, in some contexts that can be viewed as a bad thing, sure. The ancient skeptics, or I'll focus on Sextus Empiricus, whose writings we have, I mean, he certainly has something in common with that person, but he's quite a bit more single-minded about it. I mean, he has a set of techniques to ensure that he never will accept anything, or at least anything about the real nature of the world, or he or whoever the techniques are applied to. Now, yeah, I mean, there's also the use of the term skeptical in modern philosophy, where it tends to mean somebody who thinks it's impossible to know anything about some domain, about the nature of the external world, about other minds, things like that. Ancient skepticism is different from that because, I mean, that's a definite view. It's a negative view, but it's a definite view. Ancient skepticism is in the business of avoiding definite views altogether. And in that respect, maybe has more in common with, you know, skepticism as we think of it in just kind of ordinary language. So that's the basic idea, the ancient skeptic has a set of techniques for generating suspension of judgment. And yeah, Sextus thinks that's a good thing. He thinks that leads to tranquility. And so it's, you know, a way of life that is, as far as he's concerned, preferable to others.
So I guess we sort of have like a spectrum of understanding skepticism that sort of spreads across sort of modern to ancient times. So maybe at the very weakest, it's like today just saying somebody is doubtful to a set of criteria of how to understand the world, maybe with regards to, say, the scientific investigations, to being able to question whether we can ever know something, to believing we can never, ever understand anything.
All of those could be called skepticism at some time or place. Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, as you indicated, I mean, a skeptical attitude in scientific inquiry can be a good thing. I mean, it makes you, you know, really test your ideas before you come to accept a theory. And, you know, that's generally viewed as a virtue in scientific or other kinds of discovery. Yeah.
It's amazing because it is just like one word that can encompass so much and can have so many different connotations depending on what you're talking about. But I think for us, kind of focusing on skepticism, maybe with the big S, as regards to the philosophy, I think for a lot of people who don't know really anything about the ancient philosophy, maybe we can actually back up a little bit and talk about just the history of skepticism, because it's got a great ancient history. And I think it even includes Indian history as well, right?
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, that's a fascinating and I think probably unsolvable question. But yeah, so right. I mean, Sextus Empiricus is near the end of antiquity. I mean, we don't know when he lived, but probably around 200 AD or CE. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a tradition that he belongs to. He calls himself a Pyrrhonist skeptic, and that name goes back to the figure, obscure figure of Pyrrho, who lived in around 300 BCE, so almost like 500 years before Sextus himself. And yes, there is a story that he accompanied Alexander the Great on his campaigns that, you know, went eastward from Greece a long way and got as far as India. And yeah, we're told in India, or at least that's where we guess it was, he met some so-called naked wise men, and that he developed his ideas based on that, based on those meetings. It's very hard to know how much credibility to place in that. I mean, I think that there's plenty of resources within Greek thought, earlier Greek thought itself, that would explain why somebody could come along with Pyrrho's ideas. But yeah, maybe he did get some inspiration from some kind of, you know, ancient gurus in India or that general region of the world. And certainly, yeah, I mean, people often will notice a certain kind of similarity between the skeptical attitude in the ancient Greek tradition and Buddhism. But yeah, so there's the Pyrrhonist tradition, but even before that, I mean, questioning the possibility of knowledge starts almost as soon as people start engaging in sort of systematic inquiry that we now would call philosophy. They didn't call it that themselves right away. So the more sort of negative claim that knowledge is impossible, you start to get examples of that quite early in Greek thought. But yes, the idea of a sort of systematic and way a way of life that we can call skepticism, that really originates with Pyrrho. And yet it's not a continuous tradition from Pyrrho to Sextus. Pyrrho had a few immediate successors, and then the idea was kind of revived in the first century BCE by another obscure figure called Inesidemus. And then it's the tradition from that that leads to Sextus. And we don't know, we know a few names between Inesidemus and Sextus, but don't have any real details.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I got to say, just because I think previously, even for myself, I sort of thought skepticism was sort of more of a niche philosophical school of thought from the ancient world. And I guess I hadn't realized just how integral it can be to just philosophy in and of itself.
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, that's still true today. I mean, people still agonize about, you know, what do you do about skepticism? In modern European thought, it particularly is associated with Descartes and a number of people after that. But yeah, I mean, I haven't even mentioned there's another tradition of ancient skepticism that is in Plato's Academy. And the details of that are less clear because, again, we don't have any writings. And in fact, the two major figures in that tradition didn't write anything. But yes, that for a couple of centuries, I mean, around 250 BCE till the early first century, the Academy, the school founded by Plato, was skeptical in outlook, and yeah, was integral in debates with the other schools of the time, especially the Stoics. So yeah, I mean, there are sort of centuries long, yeah, a couple of centuries long face-offs between the academic skeptics and the Stoics on certain issues. So yeah, I mean, I think it is a niche school in the sense that it never got the same level of sort of public acceptance that Stoicism or Epicureanism did, but it's certainly involved in sort of elaborate debates with those other schools and takes on different ancient philosophies as well besides that.
That you mentioned Stoicism and Epicureanism, and I think those are much more popular terms today, or at least more recognizable. Mm-hmm. So it might be helpful, I think, for readers or listeners who are becoming like newly acquainted with the school of thought of skepticism to sort of maybe explain a bit of the major differences between Stoicism and Epicureanism and skepticism.
Well, I mean, the biggest difference is the Stoics and the Epicureans do have definite views about the nature of the world that they think they have good reasons for. And that's, you know, precisely the main thing that skepticism backs off from. In the case of the Stoics, I mean, they have this very elaborate worldview The world is pervaded by a benevolent God that takes the form of breath that pervades everything in the universe, and everything is fated, but it's providential. It's the best of all possible worlds, to use a phrase that has occurred elsewhere in the history of philosophy. And our goal as human beings is to sort of be in tune with the nature of the world to the greatest possible extent. And that will be the fulfillment of our human nature. And a crucial aspect of that is being clear about what really matters and what doesn't. And in fact, really nothing matters except the state of your soul, whether you're virtuous or vicious. And so all the things that we generally care about, like whether we have enough money, whether we're healthy, whether we have a respected position in society, all of those things, I mean, they're worth pursuing, but they're not things that make a crucial difference to your level of happiness, as far as they're concerned. And that's sort of the side of their view that I think lines up with the use of the word stoic in everyday language today, of sort of putting, putting up with things and not being bothered by stuff that most people would be crushed by. That there is an element of that, because things like all kinds of things that we'd normally consider horrible misfortunes, they will say, oh, well, those are just indifferent things, so it doesn't really matter. So that's a sort of thumbnail sketch of a Stoic view. The Epicureans are rather different. They don't believe in a providential God. In fact, their gods, if they even believe they exist, are serenely unconcerned with anything. And our goal is to, the idea of becoming as like God as possible, that's common to them too. But the Epicurean goal is to become as much like that kind of God. That is, again, somebody who doesn't, is not bothered by anything. And so their goal is ataraxia, tranquility. It's the same thing that Sextus has, but they think you can get to it, as I said, by coming to understand the nature of the world. And for them, the nature of the world is atoms and void. Right, if you believe that the world consists of just atoms and void, then you won't think that there are gods out to get you if you do certain things to, you know, annoy them. And so that will free you from all kinds of worries that they think regular people are beset by. And you will not, you won't be afraid of death because you won't be worried about some horrible afterlife with divine punishments and stuff like that. Because death, as they say, death is nothing to us. That is literally when you're dead, you're just nothing. Because the atoms that are your soul will just disperse. And so that's the end of you. And that's a reason to not be worried. We might not agree with them about that last point, but that's the attitude. Those are the two contrasting, in many ways, views, Stoicism and Epicureanism, that are the main non-skeptical philosophies during the period when skepticism was sort of most prevalent in ancient Greek thought.
Do they seem to have all like the same goal of trying to find tranquility?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, as I said, the Epicureans actually use the same word, ataraxia, that Sextus gives as the effect of his suspension of judgment. The Stoics don't use that word much, but it's not entirely different, the attitude that they seem to be cultivating. I mean, yes, it's not caring about things that are not, in their view, worth caring about. So yeah, I think there's a sort of general resemblance there. And I mean, it's sometimes said that this kind of orientation of philosophy, which happens in the last few centuries BCE and a little bit into the Common Era, it's often said that is an effect of the sort of shakeup in the world, the entire Greek world, caused by Alexander the Great's conquest and the growth of sort of empires after that. I don't know how much truth there is to that, really. I mean, the goal of tranquility, you can find antecedents for that in earlier Greek thought as well.
And presumably anyway, in places that weren't affected by Alexander the Great as well.
Well, people that were before he even existed. Yeah. Including earlier atomic thinkers that the Epicureans, you know, drew from quite a bit.
Well, I was also thinking of different locations too. So if you have other cultures that are interested in tranquility, that you know, wouldn't be just Alexander the Great was great, but you know, he didn't necessarily influence everything at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's right.
Now, I was going to ask, you know, it's interesting because I think there has been a renewal of interest in Stoicism and to a certain extent Epicureanism as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think skepticism is going to enjoy this same new attention, or is it too conflated with the modern interpretation?
Well, maybe. I think it could. I mean, I think I've maybe tried to do a little bit of that myself in recent years. So yeah, a collection of essays that I published a couple of years ago, it's called How to Be a Pyrrhonist. And a number of those essays do sort of explore how much of this attitude is still kind of viable for us today. And the new book, the translations of Sextus, I mean, that has the same sort of general goal as well. And I'm not the only one. I mean, yeah, there are, I can think of at least one other person who's working on a book that, I mean, she thinks is going to have the same sort of general plan, general aspirations. So yeah, there's a bit of it, but I think it hasn't achieved the degree of sort of uptake that sort of neo-Stoicism has in recent years.
We need Stepticon or something like that.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, there are blogs and things that are, you know, called the skeptic and things like that. But I think that, I mean, that's a somewhat broader notion of what skepticism is. So, as I said, none of these are unrelated to the ancient philosophy entirely.
I really like to get into your book and some of the details of skepticism. But beforehand, I just wanted to sort of finish up with sort of the historical background and context. You have mentioned Sextus Empiricus quite a few times. So he's the only Greek skeptic whose works have survived. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
So what other sources do we have for skepticism? Is he our only one?
Well, he's the only card-carrying skeptic. But beyond that, there's this book called Lives of the Philosophers by this guy, Diogenes Laertius. I actually have a new translation of it right here. And yeah, in the course of that, I mean, he has a life of Pyrrho, the founder of Pyrrhonist skepticism, and another shorter life of Pyrrho's disciple, Timon. And within that, there's quite a lot of description of the skeptical view. So that's an interesting sort of supplement to Sextus, and it's interesting to see the things that they have in common and things where they don't quite say the same thing. So that's another source. Besides that, Cicero was a student at the very tail end of the academic tradition of skepticism. And so he wrote a book called Academica, which has not survived as a whole, but quite a bit of it has survived. And that's another very important source for skepticism in this other academic tradition. So yeah, those are the main other sources. Aside from that, there are other sort of bits and pieces that you find in later antiquity of people referring to skeptics. But yeah, that's sort of hit or miss. So Sextus is not the only source, but as I say, he's the only one who was a skeptic himself, of whom we have voluminous writings. Well, I should say also, yeah, there are some fragments. So Pyrrho's disciple Timon wrote a bunch of things, but he wrote verses, and a number of those verses have survived. So that's as fragments quoted by other ancient authors. So that's another source for sort of an earlier stage, but that's quite difficult to interpret because it's only little bits and pieces.
You mentioned Cicero, so is it, and this was actually going to be a question I was going to ask before when we were talking about these sort of three different kind of popular philosophies happening at the same time. Is it possible to be a Stoic and a skeptic at the same time?
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, Cicero, in a way, does that. I mean, you know, he calls himself an academic, and they didn't use the term skeptic of themselves, but it was used about them from pretty early on. But he, I mean, his version of skepticism is a somewhat more sort of muted one than Sextus's. And for him, yeah, you can be looking for the truth, you can have some views, you just mustn't be sure about them. And you just must always be willing to revise them and never claim to have, you know, achieved the definite final truth about things. So from that point of view, you know, you can have views so long as you're suitably sort of tentative about them. And in his own writing, often it seems like the Stoic view of things is the one that he is more the most attracted to. So, I mean, there are a number of philosophical works of his that talk about different outlooks. On ends, De Finibus is a good example. So it talks about the Epicureans. He's not a fan of the Epicureans, and talks about the Stoics. He's quite a bit more sympathetic to them. So yeah, in a sense, if you're not too radical in your skepticism, if your skepticism allows for you to hold views so long as they're merely tentative, then yes, you can be a skeptic and a Stoic. But if you go all the way with Sextus himself, and only permit suspension of judgment on the true nature of things, then you couldn't be.
Well, I personally am a big fan of cherry picking, the art of cherry picking, and I think we should take the best of philosophies that we can, mm-hmm. as long as they don't contradict, of course, but there's a lot of really important things to glean. Even if you don't, like you say, take it wholesale, you can still learn quite a lot from a philosophy with regards to the perspectives it can give and insights.
Right. Yeah. And actually, I mean, within the ancient world, this is a very minority strand of thought, but eclecticism was something that some people pursued, which involved precisely sort of picking and choosing a bit from here and a bit from there.
Oh, I love it. Okay. And now I know my new favorite philosophy. okay. So maybe to dive into some of the information that we can glean from this. So in your book, How to Keep an Open Mind, An Ancient Guide to Thinking Like a Skeptic, you explain how Sextus advocated and provided a set of techniques to achieve a radical suspension of judgment about the way things really are. Which I think is really, there's a lot to delve into that. So maybe we should start off with maybe what a few of these techniques are and why we should suspend judgment in the first place.
Okay, well, so I mean, most generally, it's simply a technique of assembling opposing ideas, arguments, impressions on any given topic. So, I mean, he says what skepticism is, it's an ability to do this assembling of opposing views in such a way that they are of what he calls equal strength. And if they're of equal strength, that is, they each strike you as you know, equally plausible, equally convincing, then you'll have no choice but to suspend judgment. And the reason why that's a good thing from his point of view is because it leads to tranquility. The way he describes it is you start out, the skeptic starts out as somebody who's trying to discover the truth and get tranquility that way. And they keep on finding, well, there's all these opposing views of things. And so they end up not discovering the truth and they end up suspending judgment. And when that has happened enough times, they find themselves getting that. I mean, they thought they were going to get tranquility through discovering the truth. They find they get the tranquility through the suspension of judgment that they find themselves pushed to again and again. And so then it sort of morphs into a project of keeping and sustaining the suspension of judgment. And yeah, as far as, you know, specific techniques are concerned, I mean, the most obvious are what he calls the modes, which are sort of ready-made forms of skeptical opposition. And so, for example, I mean, there's a set of 10 modes, and the first one is different impressions that humans and animals have. So, you know, we don't see the same things the same way as animals do. Who's to say which of us get at the way things really are? We've got to suspend judgment. Second one is differences, different impressions of different humans. And, you know, maybe our different different sort of physiologies causes us to see things different ways. Maybe different opinions will make us see things different ways. Again, who's to say who's correct? And then third one is differences between different senses. And so even of the same person. So then, you know, what, how things may look one way, but they may feel another way or something like that. Again, you're leading to suspension of judgment. So the whole series of sort of oppositions on a certain topic that will, again, produce the same result. The other way that Sextus himself does it, and in most of his writings, is simply on philosophical topics of various kinds, collect the opposing views of the other non-skeptical philosophers, and which is why he's quite an important source of evidence for us for some of the other some of the other schools. In some cases, he gives us information which we don't have from anywhere else. But from his point of view, the goal is to line up all these opposing views and generate suspension of judgment that way. And if there aren't existing oppositions among the non-skeptical views, he'll think up one himself to balance the positive arguments of the non-skeptics. Sometimes the oppositions are created by the skeptics. Sometimes he's just sort of lays out views that are held by others and saying, see, they held opposing views, we got to suspend judgment. So yeah, he does it across the whole field of philosophy. There's logic, physics, and ethics. Those are the three main fields of philosophy in later antiquity. And he also does it with other kinds of expert knowledge as considered at the time. So yeah, one of his works is about six different specialized fields. So grammar, rhetoric, geometry, arithmetic, astrology, and music theory. And it's the same technique again. Have opposing views, you suspend judgment. But yes, the outcome, according to him, is tranquility. And that's what makes it all worthwhile, as far as he's concerned.
Can you suspend judgment and then come to a conclusion at the end? Like, when I think of it, you're like, it's this great idea with regards to steel manning your opponent's ideas, which used in sort of a modern context is a way that we can kind of appreciate and understand what the opposition's points are, and then yeah. If we can suspend judgment long enough to actually listen to the other side, which I think is a problem a lot of people have, then you can use that to both appreciate where your opponent's coming from, but then have a stronger position yourself at the end. But I guess in my mind, that always assumed that at the end, you could still have a judgment of some sort. You just suspended judgment long enough to be able to come to a better, more truthful, honest conclusion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with you. That's an entirely reasonable thing to do, but that wouldn't be Sextus's model. For him, suspension of judgment is what he's aiming for, and sliding into the holding of views, that would be, as far as him, that would be a problem as far as he's concerned. But that, I mean, that's one aspect where I think, we might not want to go with him 100%. We might want to sort of pick and choose what we take from him because, I don't think suspension of judgment is, well, first of all, I don't think it's going to lead to tranquility all the time. And second, I don't think it's possible for us, given how much we know about the world, which is much more than what he did.
Well, and I guess just to live life without ever having any judgment, I mean, seems like it would be hard to accomplish anything.
Well, yes. Now, I mean, he's well aware of that issue and what he says about it. And I mean, already in antiquity, there was a standard criticism of the skeptics that, you can't do anything if you don't have any definite views. What he says is, you can go along with the way things appear. That's fine. And things strike you in a certain way and you can go with the appearances. Without ever committing yourselves to how things really are. Honey tastes sweet and that affects, what we do with it, and that's fine, but you're not going to investigate the real nature of honey, and you don't care about that. As far as he's concerned, the appearances are quite sufficient for making decisions and leading a normal life. In fact, he claims that the skeptic is closer to sort of regular people than these highfalutin abstract theorists of other philosophies. That's a highly debatable issue, I think. But yeah, he sometimes will make this sort of claim, you know, I'm on the side of ordinary life as opposed to these pointy-headed Stoics and Epicureans kind of thing. He thinks there's a quite adequate response to the so-called inactivity objection. And it just says, go along with the way things appear, and what more do you need?
So it almost seems like he's the opposite of Plato. Like, just be happy with the shadows in the wall cave and don't even try to know what the forms are because you won't know them. It's impossible to know them. Content yourself with the show.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. And in fact, yeah, I mean, a number of years ago, I wrote a book on the original skeptic Pyrrho. And yeah, the way that I described Pyrrho's views essentially was Plato without the transcendent unchanging forms. You just have the messy, changeable, regular world around us. So I think and that aspect, I mean, there may be some differences between Pyrrho and Sextus, but that aspect of it goes through that whole tradition.
Now, in the ancient world, would they have taken the fullest extreme of Sextus's views, or would they have wanted to sort of take the first half of suspension of judgment, like maybe we are inclined to do today as well? I mean, was he taken as he was then, or were people also trying to cherry pick back then? Like, what did Cicero think, I guess?
I mean, he doesn't seem to get much play in the ancient world. I mean, there are very few references to him in other ancient texts. I mean, this guy Diogenes Laertius does refer to him and gives, I mean, in the life of Lives of Pyrrho and Timon that I referred to, he gives a whole sort of succession of skeptics. Not clear how much of it to believe, but he mentions Sextus in there, and he mentions a student of Sextus who we otherwise know nothing about. So Diogenes is at least a generation later than Sextus. References to Sextus in later antiquity are pretty rare. So we really don't know much at all about how he was received in antiquity. He seems to be sort of strangely isolated from his own time and place. So I think, yeah, he didn't get much of a reception in the ancient world. It's in the early modern period he's rediscovered. And that's when skepticism came to be a major topic in Western philosophy again. And since then, he's been taken seriously by a lot of different philosophers. But yes, very few people took him seriously in his own time.
Is that just because he went so far, I guess?
Well, who knows why? I mean, we really know almost nothing about him as a person. And I mean, he may have just lived in some backwater and just not been known about. Although, I mean, he presents himself as sort of one of a group of skeptics, but maybe they were all in some little teeny corner of the Roman Empire or something.
Just being super tranquil, not making any judgments.
Well, sure, yeah. why should they worry about that?
Yeah.